Hello, and thank you for joining us. My name is Jenny Pagel-Guile. I am the Executive Director of the National Pancreas Foundation. And today's webinar is Pancreatic Cancer Blood-Based Biomarker Testing. And I will share a little bit about the National Pancreas Foundation before turning it over to our speaker, Dr. Raymond Wavlo, for joining us today. The NPF is a unique organization. We focus on all forms of pancreatic disease. And over the years, we have awarded over $5 million in grants. We have over 190 centers of excellence across the country, and we support a variety of programs for patients, physicians, and care providers. We have an interactive map on our website. So if you're seeking new treatment or looking for a physician or services with a center of excellence, please feel free to use these resources. And you can also reach out to our team with the National Pancreas Foundation for any additional questions you have. Also, Camp Hope is one of our partnership programs that we do with Rebecca's Wish. It is a camp for youth with pancreatic disease in Texas. And one of the unique features is that we offer medical care that is unique to our patients so they can have a true camp experience. And so, if you or anyone on your team would like to volunteer for camp, we're always looking for nurses, doctors, physicians, camp counselors, and those applications are now available online. And again, our staff can answer any questions, but we would love to have you. We have campers from over 30 states attend. Also, one of the main resources that we have and is most popular on our website is the Animated Pancreas Patient. There's a variety of modules with information from nutrition, diagnosis, and working with your team. So we encourage you to use that as a resource with your patients and also anyone that you feel would benefit from our information. And our website also has a variety of other on-demand webinars as well based on topic. Another piece that we find is critical to our pancreatic community is healthy eating diet. And so we do have two cookbooks available for purchase on our website. Feel free to, there's some sample recipes that you can try out, but those are available for order and purchase on our website as well. Additionally, all of our centers of excellence should have received an assortment of these as well, to provide as a resource. Also, if you're joining us today and you're interested in fundraising for the National Pancreas Foundation, donations help us provide additional programs and services. There are a variety of ways that you can be involved with our organization. We have events across the country with our chapters. We also have centers or hospitals host their own fundraising events. So please feel free to ask for more information if you'd like to be more involved as a fundraiser, advocate, or participant in other NPF programs. Today's program and many others are available on our medical professional portal. These are on-demand pre-recorded webinars. Some of them are listened live. We also have an assortment of them that have been converted into podcast format, so they're more accessible. So feel free to reach out if you have questions, if you're interested in presenting, or again, these are all available on demand, free, and you don't necessarily have to be a center of excellence. We want to share this information and educate as many people as possible with our resources. To stay up to date on all NPF information goings on, please follow us on social media. And you can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter that goes out. We have a variety of events, like I mentioned, across the country and webinars such as these. And so you can sign up to get those notifications if you are on our mailing list or follow us on social media. Now I'll get started on our program, but a special thanks to Immunovia, our sponsor for today's speaker, as well as a great partner for the National Pancreas Foundation. And for today's speaker is, again, as I mentioned, Dr. Raymond Wadlow. He'll be presenting on pancreatic cancer blood-based biomarker testing. Dr. Wadlow is a gastrointestinal oncologist at Inova Cancer Institute, specializing in pancreatic and gastrointestinal cancers, with training from the University of Virginia, the University of Pennsylvania, and fellowship training at Dana-Farber Massachusetts General Hospital. Motivated by the loss of his mother, Virginia State Senator Emily Couric, to pancreatic cancer, he has dedicated his career to advancing care and research in this field. He currently serves in multiple leadership roles in Inova, including co-director of the GI Oncology Research Program, director of the High-Risk Pancreatic Clinic, and principal investigator in the PROCEED Consortium, and the author of numerous peer-reviewed publications and has dedicated his career to improving the lives of patients at risk or diagnosed with pancreatic and other gastrointestinal diseases. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I look forward to what you have to share with our group.
Thanks, Jenny, for that warm introduction. I'm really excited to be here. And thanks to the National Pancreatic Foundation and Immunovia for sponsoring today's event. Should be sharing. All right. So we have the opportunity to talk about controversies in pancreatic cancer surveillance guidelines and the role of blood-based biomarker testing. There we go. Our educational objectives are first to understand the major pancreatic cancer surveillance guidelines from a variety of different organizations, including the American College of Gastroenterology, the American Gastroenterology Association, the Gastroenterology Endoscopy Association, NCCN, and CAPS, and the key differences in recommended patient populations, imaging modalities, and surveillance intervals. And two, to evaluate how institutional variability and emerging tools like blood-based biomarker testing may influence the future landscape of pancreatic cancer surveillance. So, stepping back a little bit, let's talk about pancreatic cancer. I don't think it's lost on many people in this audience, certainly, that it's often caught at a late stage when it's most deadly. You can see the estimates for the United States in 2024 with 66,440 new cases and 51,750 deaths, which is a case fatality rate of 78%, which is extraordinarily high, making pancreatic cancer currently the third leading cause of cancer-related deaths in men and women combined. But it's expected to surpass colorectal cancer and become the second leading cause, second only to lung cancer, by 2030. And this is largely due to a couple of different factors, primarily the fact that pancreatic cancer is often diagnosed at a late stage, which you can see in the upper right-hand corner of the slide, with nearly half of patients diagnosed with distant metastases and another 30% with regional disease, which for pancreatic cancer is usually not amenable to potentially curative surgery, and then only a minority, 13%, with localized disease. And you can see below that that the five-year survival overall is 11%. I've seen as high as 13%, and it is going up from about 5% a decade ago, but still very low. And this is very, very small, 3% in the patients who present with distant disease, 14% with regional disease, and even the patients with localized disease, we end up curing fewer than 50%. And the incidence of pancreatic cancer is going up, and because the incidence to mortality ratio is so high, that's why it's expected to surpass colorectal cancer in combination with improvements in survival for that disease. Pancreatic cancer usually shows few or no symptoms until it is advanced and spread, and that's why we have this late stage of diagnosis. Okay, so a lot of hope in addition to new treatments, which we're working very hard on and for which there have been some signal developments lately beyond the scope of today's talk, but which we're bringing into the medical oncology clinic. A lot of hope for the purpose of today is focused on screening and early detection. And because we can't afford to wait for the onset of symptoms, we're focused on finding pancreatic cancer at the earliest possible stage, so stage 1A, 1 centimeter or less, or even premalignant disease. Which sometimes can be referred to as high-grade dysplasia developing from cystic lesions. And that's the ideal situation when we find a lesion that we know is destined to become cancer, but has not invaded and has not become cancer yet. And so to screen patients, we need to focus on people that are at higher than average risk. So these are individuals, for example, with hereditary cancer syndromes and/or a family history that puts them at higher than average risk. And you can see here the relative risk of developing pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, or PDAC, by genetic predisposition or family history compared to the general population. So that's a reference relative risk of one. So the highest risk syndromes are people with Peutz-Jeghers syndrome or germline mutations in STK11, which puts them at risk for a variety of different malignancies, but gives them a relative risk of pancreatic cancer of over 130. Familial pancreatitis syndrome, when there's a mutation in one of the pancreatic enzymes that predisposes to pancreatitis, has a very high relative risk of 87. Familial malignant melanoma syndrome, which is defined by inherited mutations in CDKN2A, also associated with a very high risk of pancreatic cancer. And we'll talk about screening guidelines for these patients. And then there are what we call familial pancreatic cancer kindreds. And these, strictly defined, are people with multiple relatives and who have undergone genetic testing, and there's no identifiable gene mutation. So you can see relative risk for an individual with at least three first-degree relatives diagnosed with pancreatic cancer is 32. Lynch syndrome is another genetic syndrome more commonly associated with colorectal and uterine cancer, but also increases the risk of pancreatic cancer. And then risk is still elevated, but goes down with fewer first-degree relatives. And then there are what are called the low penetrance mutations in BRCA1 and 2, PALB2, which is partner and localizer of BRCA2, and ATM, all of which confer a relative risk of approximately 6. And then finally, at the bottom, with a single first-degree relative, that relative risk is about 5. So these are the populations for whom we consider screening, but there is some lack of concordance among these different professional societies in terms of exactly who should be screened and how they should be screened. So you can see in the chart here that there's widespread agreement in the top row that we should be screening the highest risk individuals. For example, those people with Peutz-Jeghers syndrome or familial atypical multiple melanoma syndrome. Those individuals should be screened starting at age 35 in Peutz-Jeghers or 40 in PHAM syndrome, or, and this is a theme throughout, 10 years before the age of the earliest diagnosis in the family, whichever comes first. But you start to see some discordance with the lower penetration mutations like BRCA1, 2, PALB2, and ATM, with, for example, the NCCN recently changing their recommendations to consider screening for BRCA2 and ATM carriers regardless of family history. Whereas for BRCA1 and PALB2 mutation carriers, the NCCN recommends screening only if there's a first or second degree relative with a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. And that's those recommendations are a little bit different for some of the other guidelines. Familial pancreatic cancer, which is strictly defined as at least one first-degree relative who has a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, who in turn has at least one first-degree relative, all of the societies recommend screening. And I should mention, which I haven't, that the age to which we start screening is 50, except for those two high-risk mutation syndromes I discussed at the beginning. Again, 50 or 10 years before the earliest age of diagnosis in a first or second-degree relative. And then I really won't get into recommendations for pancreatic cystic disease, except to say that we do find cystic lesions in a lot of these patients, and those need to be monitored in their own right. And there are whole separate guidelines about how to monitor them depending on high-risk features. So, as you might imagine, there are a lot of challenges in how we do surveillance for these high-risk individuals. So, first, there are many patients and physicians and healthcare providers who are unaware that screening exists and that it can be done. And so a lot of patients who are otherwise eligible for screening are not currently being screened. Second, when we do screening, we tend to alternate between endoscopic ultrasound and MRI, preferably on an annual basis, one test one year and the other the next year, alternating back and forth. And this is problematic because, of course, these tests are expensive and some areas have limited access due to cost, geographic limitations, or system resource constraints. And of course, patients aren't always going to agree that this is an important priority. And we often have those conversations in my clinic about sort of where this stands relative to the patient's competing sort of priorities. It's not for everybody. But there are limitations there, and there are barriers to entry, which make this an imperfect system. So you can see then, once we start screening, if there's a normal or negative result, meaning no evidence of cancer, the patient's then typically recommended to have additional screening on an ongoing annual basis. But there's a risk of something called interval cancer development, which is when the patient develops a symptomatic cancer prior to the time recommended for their next surveillance. And obviously, that's a weakness and an imperfection of these current screening guidelines. If the screening test is abnormal or positive, if the patient had that finding on an imaging study, they typically go on to an endoscopic ultrasound with a biopsy, Okay, but all of these tests are limited in detecting the very smallest tumors on occasion. And when that biopsy is abnormal, of course, they can be diagnosed and treated. But if it's normal, they go back to their annual screening paradigm. So you can see where this is not a perfect system for a lot of the reasons that I've just discussed. And many of us who are engaged in this field are right now trying to annotate the cancers that are diagnosed and then following these patients for outcomes and survival in an effort to try to prove that screening and early detection actually saves lives. And we're confident that we're going to succeed, but of course, there's a lot of room for improvement for all of these reasons. Okay, so imaging alone is insufficient to service all patients recommended for pancreatic cancer surveillance, as we've discussed. And again, here are some of the limitations and drawbacks in this slide described specifically to the different screening modalities that we use. And I will say that we very rarely use CT scans because of the ionizing radiation. We use MRI with MRCP, alternating annually again with endoscopic ultrasound as sort of our standard screening recommendation. EUS is invasive. There's a rare but real risk of anesthesia-related complications. It can be time-consuming. Typically, patients need to have somebody who can pick them up and drop them off back at home. The visit time is longer than an hour. There's travel. And then, if the endoscopist sees a lesion that requires biopsy, the risk of procedural iatrogenic pancreatitis goes up. There are resource and access restrictions, typically limited to centers of excellence. This is done by advanced gastroenterologists with specialized training. There are places where this is very difficult to find, limitations in providers. There are significant out-of-pocket costs for all these procedures, and then scheduling can be delayed due to limited system resources. And then finally, as I mentioned, cancers can occur between surveillance intervals. And then on the right, for the MRI or a rarely CT imaging, there can be contraindications related to the administration of intravenous contrast, radiation exposure with CT scans, again, the geographic limitations, out-of-pocket costs, and the limitations of the test, which interestingly can be divided into lesions that were missed on the imaging, poor quality imaging, or geographic, or excuse me, biologically aggressive tumors. And teasing out those distinctions is going to be really important in terms of assessing the value that these screening programs provide. Okay, because a lot of this variability exists, there are differences in the way these screening programs are implemented between institutions, which creates further heterogeneity. So I've discussed resource-driven variability. Academic centers with high-volume endoscopy services may favor EUS, or when there's research and principal investigators are advanced endoscopists, of course, there may be more of a preference for EUS. Others, where radiologists are more involved and there's more expertise for MRI and MRCP, may favor that. There's patient population influence based on certain pockets with different categories of high-risk individuals or demographics, which may influence how institutions decide to engage in screening. And then there's patient-to-patient variability, of course. So when I see patients, sometimes EUS is just not practical or too expensive, and they elect to do MRI instead. Sometimes people don't want IV contrast from MRIs, or they have claustrophobia that's not easily premedicated, and they actually favor doing EUS. So there's a lot of heterogeneity. And again, I've talked about institutional preferences based on expertise. Okay, so what are the clinical implications of these inconsistent surveillance practices? Well, patients can be confused, and there can be missed opportunities. So patients move around. We live in a mobile society and patients move. And when they move and they transfer their care from one site to another, they can find themselves getting different recommendations for how to undergo screening. Or if they have family members that fit into their same risk category, you can find that one family member is getting certain recommendations and another is getting different recommendations, of course, which can breed confusion. There are barriers to broader implementation from inconsistent protocols, which make it very difficult to scale sort of the findings and the evaluation of these screening programs and to expand them into community settings and into national registries. So this is a major challenge that efforts like the PRECEDE Consortium are working to overcome. But frankly, many of the conversations we have are that we're really studying the effectiveness of screening and early detection in a real-world setting, which is another way of saying we do the best we can given all of these limitations. Okay, so how can we get better through working together? So there's a lot that can happen. This is just a slide with some examples. So genetic counselors play a huge role in determining sort of what screening, what high-risk category each individual patient fits into. So somebody with a family history of pancreatic cancer always needs genetic testing if they have not had it, or they don't, if their family member who was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer never had genetic testing, so we can understand whether or not there's a pathogenic germline mutation that that individual carries, which affects their risk. But this is also a limited resource. And so that can be a challenge in its own right. I mentioned the PRECEDE Consortium, or the Pancreatic Cancer Early Detection Consortium, which exists now at 64 sites and growing around the world, with over 10,000 patients enrolled. And the sites are working together in a registry to try to really understand at an international level what the most effective screening and surveillance strategies are for these patients, and to develop more precision-based strategies. And then finally, we're going to talk a little bit about the promise and the integration and the potential benefits of blood tests, including the newly commercially available PancreaSure tests. And there's another test on the market, Avantect, as well. We'll talk about that. Okay. So these blood tests, of course, have a lot of attraction and excitement because a blood test, of course, is a lot more feasible and easier to do than an endoscopic ultrasound or even an MRI. So the question is, are we eventually going to be able to turn to blood-based screening predominantly, or not yet is definitely the answer right now, but what role do they even have now that we have access to a couple of these tests on the market? So these are laboratory developed tests that are, again, to be clear, are exclusively dedicated to early detection of pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. So to be distinguished from the multi-cancer early detection tests, which are also generating a lot of news and excitement, and specifically in a high-risk population. So these are not tests that have been studied or are meant for the average risk population. They're non-invasive, they're blood tests. And the PancreaSure test is a multiplex immunoassay of five serum biomarkers combined in a proprietary algorithm, reflecting different aspects of pancreatic cancer biology, which you can see in the Venn diagram over on the right. So tumor microenvironment modulation, namely, for example, how tumors recruit and manage and grow their own vascular supply, growth, proliferation, and survival signaling, which are hallmarks of cancer that allow cancer cells to continue to flourish. And then, of course, another major hallmark of cancer is evasion of the immune system. And there's a lot of work that's been going into immunotherapies for patients with diagnosed pancreatic cancer. So it's a wide snapshot of pancreatic cancer biology. And this multiplex immunoassay is now available from CLIA certified laboratory in Durham. And the result that's generated is a binary qualitative actionable test result. So it's not a number, as with some other tests, it's an either positive or negative result. And this is similar to the Avantect test, which uses different biology based on 5-hydroxymethylcytosine circulating tumor DNA biomarkers, so different biology. The PancreaSure test is very sensitive in detecting stage one or stage two pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, and this has been shown in two different studies, the CLARITY study and the VERIFY study. So you can see the sensitivity is approximately 75 to 80%, 77.6% combined in the two studies, and the specificity 92.2%. So remember, these are features, characteristics of the test. That basically have to do with the performance of the test when the diagnosis or absence of a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer is known. But of course, what we really want to know for the clinic in the real world, when we don't know if the person standing in front of us has pancreatic cancer or not, is what does a negative test or a positive test mean? And hearkening back to our whatever epidemiology training we had, those are defined as the negative and the positive predictive value. And those measurements are hugely contingent on what the prevalence of the disease is in the population. And even in a high-risk cohort, the prevalence of pancreatic cancer is relatively low. Remember, for most of these high-risk patients, their lifetime risk of getting pancreatic cancer is less than 10%. And so, in a pool of high-risk patients at any one time, the prevalence of pancreatic cancer is going to be low. And so, if you estimate a 1% prevalence of disease, the negative predictive value is very high. So, a negative test is very helpful, but a positive test is still much more likely to be false positive than true positive. And that's the challenge that we have in these clinics going forward, is we need to validate clinical pathways for responding to a positive test, especially when follow-up imaging is unrevealing. But in the meantime, this is something that's a work in progress, and it's a discussion that we're having with our patients. And this is a tool that is definitely added to the armamentarium of what's available for putting patients at ease. So the discussion I have with my patients is, if we can't do an MRI or an EUS for whatever reason, or if we need to do a test at a more frequent interval, then this is something that we can consider, and that especially a negative test can be hugely reassuring. Whereas a positive test, we really need to consider the implications of that before we order the test. Okay. So in conclusion, guidelines remain heterogeneous with significant controversies. Imaging alone is imperfect. The implementation of surveillance is inconsistent, leading to impact on patients and how these decisions are made. Blood-based tests are an important step forward in the tools that we have at our disposal for helping these patients, but there remains a lot of work to do in terms of prospectively validating these tools and figuring out just how they should be used in the clinic. Future will likely consist of a multimodal approach to surveillance, including both non-invasive blood-based biomarkers and imaging studies as well. So with that, I'll stop just a couple minutes early, and we'll open it up to questions. So I have a question from Jay. You mentioned the various guidelines for monitoring for pancreatic cancer, for example, IPMNs or intraductal papillary mucinous neoplasms, which are cystic lesions in the pancreas that can be premalignant. However, there's no standard for monitoring, leading to institutional differences. What is preventing the development of a universal standard of monitoring? Well, I think just the research is still ongoing. There's a cooperative group study that was being run by ECOG looking at comparing different guidelines, for example, surgical guidelines versus the radiology guidelines. And I think it's just a reflection of the fact that we don't have a full understanding yet on how aggressively we should be monitoring these patients. There are many, many, many subcentimeter IPMNs with no high-risk stigmata that are never going to develop into invasive disease. And so we would like to de-escalate surveillance for those patients for obvious reasons, whereas it's critical that we not lose the opportunity to diagnose and prevent the development of invasive disease in patients. So I think just more work needs to be done. I've heard of other blood tests, CancerGuard and GRAIL. What are the differences between all of these? So those are the so-called, I mentioned, multi-cancer early detection tests. So very different. So those are tests that are designed to look for many different kinds of cancer with a single blood test in an average risk population. Whereas again, remember, PancreaSure and the Evantec test and others in development are specifically focused on people at elevated risk of pancreatic cancer, and they are specifically designed to detect pancreatic cancer only. How do I order a test? Will my doctor know about these? A doctor needs to order the test. So it's really all about education and getting the people who are seeing patients that are at high risk aware of these options and having that conversation. And once there's awareness, then ordering the test is not difficult through the website. So it would encourage you to have that conversation with your doctor. What is the typical procedure for a patient when you take the blood testing? It's a simple blood test, and then the blood gets processed and sent to the lab. And the turnaround time for the results, I don't actually recall what it is off the top of my head, but it's fairly quick. And then there's a portal, and the physician gets the results and has the discussion about that with the patient. So it's quite straightforward. Are the tests available in Canada? Good question. I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry, but I'm sure that that can be figured out and hopefully communicated to you, but I don't know. Let's see. In the chat, when should we start screening for pancreatic cancer in children presented with AP or ARP with a genetic background, for example, PRSS1 positive? Also controversial, I think it depends, but in general, again, as I said, we would start at age 50 or 10 years before the age of diagnosis in the family, or in somebody that's had clinically significant pancreatitis. In the family, we'd want to start pretty shortly after that. What is the status of mRNA vaccines to treat pancreatic cancer? A lot of excitement. These are in investigational development. There are ongoing trials. Would refer you to the publications and the scientific presentations. So I think there's a lot of hope for treating minimal residual disease with these vaccines. I think the clinical niche is going to be for postoperative after completion of adjuvant chemotherapy. Can you discuss your plan for more collaboration across disciplines of providers when patients are under care from different types of physicians, like the surgeon collaborating with the advanced endoscopic doctors, and conversations with the patient on all aspects of care so they can be fully informed of their choices? Yeah, I think what this is alluding to is that because of the uncertainty and heterogeneity in this field and the extent of the research that's still required, it's critical that this really be done in a center that has interest and expertise across all of the relevant disciplines. And of course, that is in tension with access, right? The higher the bar we make for accessing this kind of screening, the more difficult it is for people to access. And I think that's one of the promises of blood-based testing. But I would say in the meantime, screening really should be done at a place that has experience and knows what it's doing. And that one of the sort of the major criteria of that are providers in all of the disciplines who are interested in this, who have a program, who have ideally are doing this in the context of a research protocol. And who communicate well together and communicate with the patient. If a person has a distal pancreatectomy, should they be tested and are they at risk? Well, it depends on what the surgery was, why the surgery was done. If there was a distal pancreatectomy for cystic disease or cancer, then absolutely. The best person to be to undergo genetic testing is the individual in the family with cancer. Unfortunately, that can be challenging because people with cancer are often sick and have a lot of competing stresses and priorities. So it doesn't always get done. But it's best if an individual diagnosed with pancreatic cancer gets genetic testing. And that's now a recommendation from NCCN to do that universally. So in the medical oncology clinic, we were losing a lot of opportunities for doing that by referring our patients to our genetic counselors, which, required these patients with pancreatic cancer to make another appointment. And again, there's a lot going on. So now we're ordering the genetic testing in our medical oncology clinic and only referring the positive patients to the genetic counselors. And it's allowed us to get this done much more efficiently. So I guess the answer to the question is it depends on what the diagnosis was. Okay, I'm just going to go back to the Q&A and make sure. Okay, if I hear you correctly, a negative result is high, just so we're talking about pancreas sure here, I'm guessing. A negative result is highly conclusive. Agree, given negative predictive value of well over 95%. If you test negative, do you still need EUS and or MRI, and how frequently should the test be run? So the answer is yes. So remember, screening is not a single test. Screening is a program. So it's just a snapshot in time. So I think for an individual who elects to have a blood test and is negative, they can be reassured that at that moment, it's very unlikely that they have an undiagnosed pancreatic cancer. But if they belong to a high-risk cohort, they should continue their screening. So it depends on when the blood-based test was being done. If it's done in place of an imaging test, then typically I would recommend that they continue with annual screening. If it's done at the midpoint between imaging tests, then they should continue with their next scheduled imaging test. How frequently the blood test should be done is a fantastic question, and the answer remains, we don't yet know. That is an ongoing topic of debate and conversation, and I think one of the questions that needs to be answered before these tests are widely adopted. Can there be more collaboration between the different doctors about their care and the choices communicated with the patient, the surgeon, and the advanced endoscopic doctor? Yeah, I mean, right. I think there should be. Again, I think there's, to the extent that these clinics are run by certain types of practitioners that may be that may bias what's offered. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It may reflect the expertise in that center. That's one of the reasons why I enjoy doing this. I'm a medical oncologist, so I don't do the endoscopies myself. I think that I'm unbiased in terms of, how we do our testing. But I think asking the question about, EUS versus MRI, pros and cons, it should be a discussion that every patient has. If I receive genetic testing for breast cancer, would those results also show genes associated with pancreatic cancer? Depends on what the testing was. The details are really, really, really important. If it was panel testing, and you should be able to tell that from the report, then the genes tested should include all of the genes that we're typically testing for with pancreatic cancer as well. But if it was spot testing for things like BRCA1 or 2, then it may not. So it's really important that you review your testing results with your physician to make sure. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time and the attention. And again, thanks to the NPF and thanks to Immunovia for sponsoring today's event.